This is Raymond C. Ferguson. I'm interviewing Oliver M. Hayden at his apartment in Falk Manor North, Wilmington, Delaware. This is Tuesday, February 18th, 1986. Mr. Hayden, you have a Doctor of Science degree.
Well, it's an honorary degree.
Right. Does anybody ever call you doctor?
I don't bother with that. About the only place you get called doctor is my ACS literature. They always use it. But, no, I don't.
And you go by Bill.
Right.
Where did that arise?
Well, it's a long story. My father was stone deaf. And as a little shaver, we were very close. And he could read my lips. So whenever he would go to town to do business with a lawyer or the bank or anywhere of that sort, he would take me along, and I was his ears. People would talk to him, and I would repeat it to him, and he could read my lips. So we got along wonderfully, but the people got to have, his name was William, and he was called Bill. And he was called Will, but people used to say, well, there goes old Bill and young Bill. That's the way it was developed, and that just name has sort of stuck with me all through my life. I rather like it.
Yes. Okay, from your biography that you put into the Del Kim Bulletin on your 50th anniversary of the ACS, you did say that you were born in Windsor, Connecticut.
Right.
I don't have your birth date.
Oh, that's August 20, 1893.
And your father's name, you said, was William?
William Owen Hayden.
And your mother?
Catherine Mariah Mills.
And you said your father was a tobacco farmer.
Yes, he was a tobacco farmer in the Connecticut Valley, where they raise the finest tobacco grown in the United States. Simply, it's grown only, primarily, for the outer leaf of a cigar. And then it burns with a very white ash, and it's a high-grade tobacco. Most of it, of course, when I was a youngster, it was grown out of doors, and we grew two kinds of tobacco, called the broadleaf, and the other was called the Havana. And then, because the seed had been brought up from Havana, Cuba. But later on, that same tobacco is grown under tents, under cloth. And the idea is not, as many people say, to protect it from I don't know what, but it is grown to filter the light a bit. And you get a very rather spindling growth, but it's the kind of growth that you want for the texture, for the leaf, outer leaf, for the outer wrapper for a cigar.
You don't smoke?
No, I haven't smoked since 1951. When I had a bad cough, you can tell from my voice, I still have a residual bronchitis left over from the days that I did smoke, because I was a heavy smoker. And my son-in-law, who was a doctor, happened to be, we were at his house, and I was coughing a bit, and I said to him, Bob, did you have something to stop this cough? Oh, he said, I don't know, I'll try. He went out, and of course he came back with a little pill. I don't know what it was, and he handed it to him. He said, oh, of course, if you wanted to stop that cough, but it's no use to talk about it, because you probably haven't got the guts to stop it. And so I was smoking a cigarette, and I stubbed it out, and I've never touched a smoke of any kind since then.
That's Dr. Robert Freilich.
Yeah.
He used to be my internist.
Is that right?
Kind of a tough nut, too.
I heard he was.
Maybe he was gentler with you.
He's a very fine fellow. I'm very, very fond of him.
He treated my dad, my father, one time, and kept him from having to go into a hospital for a very serious operation. I was really always very appreciative of him. Had a very high opinion of him. A good doctor. Well, did you consider staying in the tobacco farming business, or when did you decide to get in?
No, I don't know. You know, That's also a kind of a long story. My father had a cousin, of course he would be a cousin to me, old cousin Jim Hayden. And I was very fond of the old gentleman. And oft times when I'd be coming back from school, I'd stop in his house and we'd sit and crack a few old wallets open and talk to each other, maybe have some cookies that the old lady had made up. And we talked a lot. And I used to ride, always drove oxen around the farm, and I often used to sit in the back of the ox cart with him and talk. And I was only a little shaver, but he had gone to Yale and graduated from Yale. And he often said there was a great advantage in life if you enjoyed the classics and if you studied a little bit. And if you could possibly go to college, why go? And my father wasn't very much for going to college. He thought, I'd better just stay on the farm. But of course, if I really wanted to go to college, okay. So I went to college. That's how I happened to go. And then I just never went back to the farm. Meanwhile, he sold off the farm, and that was it.
Your mother have any education beyond school?
No, high school, that's
high school.
All, yeah.
Father?
Well, my father went to Williston, that's a boarding school, or Wilbraham, both Williston and Wilbraham. I'm a little bit mixed up as to which one he went to. And I think he put in about one semester at Williams, but he had some kind of problem there.
Hazing?
Hazing. And he didn't like it, so he left.
You went to public schools then?
Oh, sure. Yes, I went to
grade school and high school.
I went to a little one-room country schoolhouse. I had the same teacher all the way through until I went away to high school. And going to high school meant going to ninth grade. And then following ninth grade, we went on through high school. But I actually had just the one teacher. And I suppose in this little school, it may have been 20, 30 children, blacks and whites, because we had quite a black population due to the plantation, the tobacco plantation. Putting those in. Never was any thought about segregation, except that they, by choice, would go with themselves. And I never heard about prejudices at all till long after.
Your farm then was well out of town, well outside of Windsor, was it?
Pardon?
How far was your farm from Windsor?
Well, from the center of Windsor, it was about... one was 3 miles, another one, I guess, was five. There were two farms.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one of the farms is not at present day is the Bradley Field, Hartford to Springfield Airport, International Airport.
Oh, that's right.
And as a boy, I cultivated that land with horses, place it now that's the airfield.
How large was Windsor, Connecticut in those days?
I think the population was about 7,000 at that time.
So it was really a very small town.
Yeah, a small town.
Farming community, I gather.
The town of its center, there was a place called the Eddy Electric, which later became one of the part of the General Electric. And in the outlying village of Pequannock, wherever, a lot of cotton mills, and there was a lot of sheeting made. There were also some paper mills, one paper mill, but it was predominantly, the farming, one, and two, the bedroom of Hartford.
I see, and then when you went to high school in Windsor, did you have to board there, or did you...
First, I used to, for the first year or so, I rode horseback. And then the trolleys came through, a trolley line put through, and they used to go back and forth on the trolley.
These were electric trolleys?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Hartford and Springfield Street Railway. That's long gone.
And this went near your farm?
Yes, went right through. Well, that was in 1911 when I graduated from high school. That's the time that my father sold the farm, and he moved into, not into town, but nearer the town, and on the main road, and built a new home, and the trolley car went right by there. But previous to that, I had gone through school leaving from the farm, and I used to either go horseback or walk a half a mile down to the trolley, and then take the trolley into town.
What do you recall about your school experiences in high school? Did you have science of any kind?
Well, of course, in those days, our high school, there were 12 in my class, and our high school consisted of three rooms. So we had a Latin teacher, had a German teacher, a physics teacher, and an English teacher, and I think the physics teacher taught mathematics. At the moment, I can't think who taught us history, but we had some American history and ancient history. We had probably one of the finest English teachers that anyone's ever had in a high school. She was a wonderful woman and excellent teacher. Well, in my, say there were, my class, I always think there were four of us out of that 12 that are the boys that went away to college. One fellow got homesick, and he came back in about 6 months. He went to the same college that I did. And two other boys went to Harvard. Of course, I went to Clark. One of those boys was Fred Nelson, who later wrote part of the editorial page of the Saturday Evening Post. The other brother was John C. O'Brien, that was a Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was two newspaper boys.
Yes.
And of course, I went on to Clark, and I took a Bachelor of Arts with a major in chemistry, and because I had the usual general and inorganic and qualitative, quantitative, qualitative, organic, and general organic. What was the thing to do?
Was Clark a fairly small college then?
Very small college then. There were about 50, and then Clark was a university and the college both. We had a separate president, G. Stanley Hall, the president of the university, and Stanford, S-A-N-F-O-R-D, was president of the college. We were privileged, if we wished, to audit university courses, and often we did. It was something we were interested in. But the college itself, I judged there were maybe 250 in the college part of it. There were 50 in my class, as I recall it, and we probably graduated about 30, because it was very stiff. 3 years, we were supposed to go through in 3 years, and you were supposed to, it was a no-nonsense college. We had no intercollegiate activities, whatever. We had a good many intramural activities. But, that college was founded by old Jonas Clark, who was a no-nonsense old manufacturer, actually. And he thought, if you're going to go to college, you better go to college and get an education and not get fill around with anything. So we worked hard. Activities were 6 days a week, and always had Saturday was just the same as Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. And we did a lot of work, and oft times went back Sunday morning to do our laboratory work.
Did the university offer graduate degrees at that time?
Oh, yes. It was it may sound a little boastful, but it was one of the leading universities of the United States. Very well, greatly recognized for psychology all over the world. Oh, they brought men like, they had men like Freud, Charcot, Janet, and all those very, very principal men. And then later they became very noted for the, not only psychology, but for geology. It's even today, it's a very noted university for geology.
Did any of these people come visit the campus while you were there? People like Freud or...
Well, Freud, as I remember, I audited some lectures by, I don't remember which one, but Freud came, I can't remember, it was just before or just after I was there. I always heard great tales about Freud. And,
when and how did you decide to major in chemistry?
How did I decide to?
Yeah.
Well, because in high school there was no chemistry taught. I had pretty good courses in physics, and I just had natural curiosity. What was the other side of the science? And I kind of wanted to find out about chemistry. And that's how I got in, really got interested, and once you're in it, I got very much interested in it, and loved the laboratory work especially. And we had there weren't very many written examinations. The school actually was run very much on the, as a European university, I think. I'd be working in the laboratory at the bench, and a professor would come sidling up to me and say, "Well, what are you doing this morning, Mr. Hayden?" And he'd talk about, "Well, why are you doing this?" And tell me about it. First thing you know, you'd be talking to him for maybe half an hour. He'd be quizzing him. Then he'd say, "How would you like to go to my house tonight and have donuts and coffee?" And that was your, you go over to his house, that was your oral exam. He'd have two or three of the fellows in the class, and we would sit down. And he wasn't satisfied until you absolutely understood what you were doing. And it was very helpful, but at the same time, finding out how much you knew, where your weak points are, and what you should be doing. It's a very unusual sort of...
Did this mean you didn't really have a formal laboratory program as such?
Oh, yes. You had a formal laboratory program.
But
you had the things to go through, but you might be following the book. But that didn't mean you knew why or what you were doing.
Yes.
He'd find out whether you knew what you were doing or not. Very helpful way.
So you had subjects like qualitative chemistry?
Yes. We had the usual thing.
Quantitative analytical chemistry?
Yeah. Again. Well, we didn't know much about atomic chemistry, nuclear chemistry.
Right.
It wasn't heard of. My textbook, I remember, was Ira Remsen, Organic Chemistry. Ira Remsen of Johns Hopkins. There's a book about inch and a half thick. That's about all they knew about organic chemistry.
Organic chemistry in those days was probably pretty much oriented towards agricultural chemistry.
Yes, that's right. We did have a shelf of Beilstein for reference, because that's where most of the organic chemistry was done, is over in Germany.
I see. Do you remember your professors in particular, or by name, any of them?
Well, I should remember them very much.
I don't worry about names.
No, I really can't.
When we do go to editing the transcript, we could always insert a name or something. I guess I was asking, is there somebody that you can remember who particularly influenced you in terms of your career or your goals?
It's strange, I can't think. Well, Benny, all I think there is Benny, who's our inorganic professor. I know he was a Harvard graduate. I can't think of his last name.
Well, we probably ought to push on. We hardly got you out of school yet. And so you got your honorary doctor's degree from Clark University in 1955.
I'd have to look it up because I did. And I got it more from the work that I was doing through the American Society of Testing Materials, which I was working very much interested in getting standard quality and performance tests that would be that could be used to make rubber products that would suit the ASME, Automotive Society, ASE it was. And I did an awful lot of work in cooperation with them, and it was, I think, I've always thought that it was the result of that work that I was given the PhD, the SCD from Clark.
Yes, well that was, in fact that's one of the things as I was looking through your career, it seems to me that there are a lot of your career that was kind of hidden in the
internal. I never would classify myself.
I work at DuPont, significantly.
You know, you think, I say I graduated with a major in chemistry, but I never considered myself as a real chemist. I was associated with chemistry, and actually, my work in rubber in the early days was more art than it was science. And later on, of course, it developed a science, but always I was interested in the performance, very much interested in performance, in developing qualities out of rubber or synthetic rubber, whatever we had, to forget some particular requirement, meet some need in industry.
We'll come back to that with some questions later, perhaps. I just wanted to get some dates set. You graduated from high school then in...
I graduated high school in 1911. Clark University in 14.
1914.
That's right.
Okay, and just as World War One was beginning.
Well, when I graduated in 1914, jobs were mighty darn scarce. I had been... not feeling too well, and as I don't think there's anything for your record, but when you were graduating, it was a thing to do for everybody to take out $1,000 endowment insurance policy to the college and give it to the college as part of their endowment. And when I came up for my examination, I was found that I had rather serious kidney trouble. As a matter of fact, they told me I'd better go home to die. And as a result, I could never get life insurance. All I could ever get was the GI insurance that I had. But anyway, I had what they called acute albuminuria. And I was home for some time and in bed for some time. I had a complication there with a rheumatic fever. And it all turned out to be due to my tonsils. I had very bad strep throat and strep tonsils. And once that was removed, I became normal health. And I didn't know what to do for a job. As I say, I was somewhat interested in the job in Michigan. And work with the Michigan Telephone Company. But I took a job with the Phoenix Mutual Life Insurance Company in Hartford, and for about 6 months worked there and shifted over to the Hartford Accident and Indemnity Company, and worked at that time as a claim adjuster. And the war broke out when I joined a group from Hartford, and that was the start. Actually, before we got into the hostilities ourselves, we were thinking about organizing an ambulance squad with the Red Cross and going overseas. Instead of that, when the war came in April, we all went into the that same group went into the medical department and went in the army. We were all sworn in August of 1970, and the whole kit and caboodle of us.
Now, what kind of group was this? This was a group of Hartford employees?
This is a group of Hartford, mostly all the young people from Hartford, a nucleus actually from the University Club in Hartford. It was a... I can't think. It was always called Dr. Somebody's Group, and I can't think of that name. She could probably remember it. And we were called to duty in August, and we were all shipped to Fort Ethan Allen, and the headquarters there were the 2nd Cavalry. And then they brought in the Vermont National Guard, and we were still kept as more or less independent group, except that we were under the control of the 2nd Cavalry. One of their colonels was our commanding officer, and until August of that year, when they went through all of our qualifications, and we were all sent to a new reforming hospital in Augusta, Georgia. It was to serve the 28th Division of Pennsylvania National Guard, and a recruiting station, but where all the Southern draftees were sent for indoctrination and for training.
Called an induction center,
basic training center. We had about over 60,000 troops coming in there, and then they put us in the wards in the hospital. And then they moved. I moved out of there, went into the clinical laboratory, and worked there for about a year, during which time I had that flu, but I recovered from that. And one day I called up the colonel's office, and he told me that I was a commissioned officer, and I was going to be sent to Yale, where I did go to take a course in toxicology. It seems the Germans were on the retreat and were poisoning water and whatnot. And I had a group that was organized in San Antonio, Texas. And it was a mobile laboratory on motorcycles with the cases mounted on the motorcycles with whatever apparatus you might need for a certain qualitative tests. And we were all assembled at Hoboken. Armistice came. The ship was there. We never got on the ship. It was the old Crown Princess Victoria, I remember. So we were immediately shipped to Camp Crane in Allentown, and from Camp Crane, Allentown, to a base hospital in Otisville, New York, where I was located for about 1 year, and we had all kinds of jobs to do. I was in what they call the Sanitary Corps, USA, and we did everything from helping to put in and control the quality of water, can do some work on the sewage disposal, and besides doing all sorts of the normal amount of clinical laboratory work. And I was in that until they discharged in October 1919. Meanwhile, I married in April 1919.
We're just running to the end of the tape, so why don't we pause now and I'll turn the tape and we can start off again where you were. Okay, Bill, let's back up just a little bit. You talked about this unit that you were heading that was in San Antonio. Did you go down to San Antonio?
No. I was to meet them in Hoboken.
I'm just trying to check the volume here a little bit. My voice has been a little loud, I think. You're coming through fine. Sounds good. Okay, now, I think according to your records, you were discharged then somewhere around 1919.
And yes, it was October 1919 at some fort up in Rhode Island. I don't even remember which fort it was, but...
And so you did, in fact, get to take advantage of your chemical training.
Oh, yes.
In the Army.
But it was clinical testing, yeah, clinical work, which I enjoyed very much.
Well, now, your wife's name is Dorothy. What was her maiden name?
Clark.
Dorothy
Lucille Clark. She'd like to forget the Lucille. You don't like it. Dorothy Clark.
But it's on the tape.
Dorothy Clark.
According to your biography, you knew her from childhood.
Oh, I knew her when she was 4 years old.
Is that right? That's a long courtship.
That's right.
And you were...
Well, it just so happened that we happened to go to the same church. She was came there as a stranger, and I remember she came there as a little girl, as just somebody new to come in the church, and she was quite a stunning girl, and I can remember exactly how she was dressed and know about it. And I probably didn't see much of her till we got to high school. And then we renewed our acquaintances, but in high school, we used to go in the crowd. We never went, you never had any girl you went steady with. And we'd always go out canoeing or sleigh riding or whatever it was. I used to see her when I came home from college for vacations. And she went to Smith. And we used to see each other, usually during the summertime or during vacation. But I don't know, I got in the Army, and I guess absence, you begin to think more about home folks. And we just took it for granted that we'd be married. That's about all there was to it.
You corresponded.
So I finally got of course we had arranged it, but I got a leave of absence for 3 days from Friday morning, I guess it was, until Monday morning. And I went from Otisville, New York, over to Windsor. We were married. Coming back and spent one night in New York as a honeymoon. Back at the camp the next day, and that was it.
What was her major at the Smith?
I think it was German. Dot. Well, she's asleep, I guess. She was always interested in art, but I'm quite sure her major was German, and her minor was mathematics, because when she graduated, she got a job with one of the insurance companies in Hartford, in the actuarial division, and she was there and worked there during the war. Until I married her April 1919. And it was there that she found that she could get credit for art. She always loved to paint. These paintings are all hers. And that was the old farmhouse where I was born and raised.
Oh, in
Connecticut. In Connecticut, yeah.
When was that painted then, when she was young?
I don't know when that was painted, probably 20 years ago or something of that sort.
The farmhouse is still there now, or has it?
No, it burned, unfortunately, after we left it.
Oops.
And it burned, I think, in Well, I don't know. I can look it up very quickly, but...
Well, that's interesting. Now, I guess while we're... you were discharged then as a lieutenant, first lieutenant, or...?
No, I was Shaved Tail, second lieutenant.
Second lieutenant. Mm-hmm. Right.
Then I stayed in the reserve. Well, actually, I stayed in the reserve about 5 years after I came to Wilmington. And I was then the first lieutenant in the reserve. But I got other interests, and just after I ran my term out, I just quit.
Reserves took quite a bit of time.
Yeah.
Did you have to go for 2 weeks training then?
Yes, yeah.
Once a year, and
yes,
as well as weekends.
Yes, and I've got interfering with
yeah, certainly would.
Other things, yeah.
Might be appropriate to talk about your family. I know your son was killed in an automobile accident. Mm-hmm. And your daughter is Jane.
Yes, my daughter is Jane.
Frelick.
And she went to the same high school that I went to. She was a class behind me in high school. And then after high school, her mother was quite sick, and she spent a year home. And then she went to Smith. And she graduated from Smith in 1917. And only when they were, I'm talking about my wife.
That's all right. I'm glad we stepped back a little bit.
All right. Well, that's her story. But
yeah.
Now, my daughter, she graduated from Friends in Wilmington. She went to the public schools up until high school, and then she went to Friends. For Friends, she went to Oberlin, and she had in mind that she would study medicine. But she was dissuaded from that because she was told that she was just too sympathetic, and that she would take her cases too personally. So she went to Yale Nursing School, and she graduated with a B.S. in nursing from Yale. And she practiced that and stayed in Yale at Grace Memorial Hospital for some time. And then she was supervisor of nurses. And she met Bob Frelick, who was a senior at Yale Medical School. And they were married. He went in the Army. And she came to Wilmington and stayed with us a short time.
Well, he was in the Army during World War II then, is that
yes,
the period?
Yeah. And he was sent out to Madigan General Hospital, and she went out there with him, and then next thing, he thought he would be shipped to over Japan or some of the islands, but he wasn't. He was sent to Germany. And so Jane, by that time, their daughter was born, and Susie, and so they all went to Germany. And Jane was very active with, I don't know whether she was actually in charge of the clinic in Heidelberg or not. I think she was. Bob found that they wanted someone to look after the, see, this was after the war was over, and there were a good many civilian people there, and he was sort of put in, he became the doctor, the family physician for the many of the American families in Munich. And he was in Munich and Jane was in Heidelberg. Well, there they were until the war ended, and he came back, and he came back over here. And
was Jane in the Army Nurse Corps?
She worked as a civilian employee for the Army.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think you have 5 grandchildren?
5.
Oh.
You want to know about them?
Well, we can run down quickly.
Well, very quickly. The oldest one is Susie. And she married, she graduated from Western Reserve, and married a fellow by the name of Willie, who for a while was was a business administrator of a hospital in High Point, North Carolina, then came to Beebe Hospital, and now he's in real estate in Dover. Susie was still love. She went. She worked at the medical school of Duke for a while. Became somewhat of a specialist I can't think of the name of the microscope.
Electron microscope.
Yeah. Yes. And she was when she. After she came back, she became interested in more education, and she went to, of course, she had a family. She had two children. One was adopted, but she went to Temple, and weekends and night school, and she's right now, she has finished her dissertation and on a PhD. Oh, she's writing her thesis. It's all everything's all been done for that. The second girl was went to Clark, and in her third year, of course that's a 4-year school now. In her third year, she disappeared as so many of the '60s do. Became a hippie and just out of sight, and her family didn't know where she was. She always kept in contact with me. I always knew where she was, and she was. I was seen to be the only one, I guess, because she thought I was an old roué or something. I don't know. But yeah. She kept. She thought I was the only one who was sympathetic with her. Well, she, after about a year of banging around like that, she found out that she was being used, and because she'd had a, we'd given her an automobile, and that was. Disappeared. We'd given her a typewriter, and that had disappeared. We'd given her TV, and that had disappeared, and whatnot. She finally got sick of the whole thing. She went to Boston, and caught up, got a job working for the Quakers in a kind of a repair place where old clothes were brought in, and laundered, and looked over and mended. And she got started. Then she realized, well, what a fool I've been. I better go back to college. So she went to BU, graduated, and then stayed on and got a BS. And then she got very much interested in international things. And she went to the school of, I don't know the name of it, it's in Bellows Falls or New York, Massachusetts, School of International Training or something of that sort. And then she, as most of the children did in those days, she got interested in the Peace Corps and went, I don't know, she went to Germany for some good reason, I don't know what. And then when the earthquake happened in Guatemala, she went down there for the Red Cross, was down there for quite a while. Then, then she was sent, I think it was the Peace Corps, but I'm never quite sure about it because I never wanted to talk to find out too many details about her life at that time. But she was down in the South Pacific on an island that had about, was responsible for about 5,000 Cambodian refugees. And she came back from that, and she was sent to Afghanistan, and I think she was under, that was under the, it was the auspices of the State Department through a recommendation from the University of Southern California. She was actually on the faculty of University of Southern California. And she finished the first year, and then they asked her, she's quite fluent in languages. And she was became very fluent in Parsi. So she was asked to be, to translate a technical book from English into Parsi, and she stayed an extra year over there for that. And when the Russians came in, she was living next door to the palace. And I said, "What did you do when they started bombing the palace?" She said, "What do you think I did? I got down under the dining room table, stayed there." And the next day, she was flown out by a military plane, And through that way, she got really got to know people in the State Department. Then she went, took special training in the State Department, and she's now a consul in the embassy at Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. So,
interesting.
She's had quite a life.
Yeah.
And she loves it. So let's see. Then the third one went to, never can think of the name of the college.
Another daughter? The third daughter?
The third one, yes. Sally. I'll have to ask Dorothy what the name of the college is. It's right on the border between of Wisconsin, southern border of Wisconsin, not Davidson. What is it? Oh, makes me think I can't think of the name of it. I have to let it go. But she was always got interested in urban affairs. And she went 1 year to, apparently this college had, you have exchanges. She went to York University in Toronto and took a course in urban affairs and just loved it. Then she came back. She went over to London and spent a little time at the University of London doing some more work on the urban affairs. And then she thought she wanted to do some traveling while she was over there. So she and another girl got an automobile and they traveled through Yugoslavia and whatnot. And finally they went down. She had an uncle that was in the Peace Corps and he met her in Kenya. They got a panel truck and drove across Africa, two girls together. And they came home, and that's where she met a young fellow who was traveling. And after she got home, well, they got together, and he was from New Zealand. So they're now married here in Wilmington. He's with the Dean Witter Company. They're quite happy. They have two little children. So then they've got one boy. He went to Oberlin, and from Oberlin he married after he got out of Oberlin, let's see, he was a kind of a, well, he's a bookish sort of a boy. He was a Phi Beta Kappa at Oberlin. He married a girl from Wilmington. They were both in high school here in Brandywine. She wanted to get into medical school and couldn't find a medical school, but she is Jewish. And so New York University took her on and told her that if she would go to University of Israel, Hebrew University, and the medical school. And she did right, she graduated, she could get her degree from NYU. So the boy who had married her went over there with her, and he got a job teaching in English to English students from the English colony, an American colony in Jerusalem. And they came back, she got her degree. She did her internship at the University of Maryland. She's just now finishing her residency at the University of Maryland. And I think she's going to practice maybe in Baltimore, I don't know, or Washington. He works for, I don't know what the name of the company is, but they say he was very much interested in Amnesty International, but he's not with them. It's with some organization in Washington that has to do with civil rights in other countries. I don't want to get into it because I don't know enough about it.
Yeah.
Not interested. And the third boy, the second boy, the youngest, was I think spoiled by the too many brothers and sisters. And anyway, he was very allergic to books. And between you and me, I think he got through Brandywine High School because they're tired of having him around. I don't know. But anyway, he floated around here and there. He's now living in Los Angeles and is working at commercial photography and doing a pretty good job. But he's just a high school boy. But I think he feels that he is a kind of a misfit with his rather brilliant other children.
That's a hard act to follow.
Very hard. I really think he feels that.
Very lucky in your dad.
Because he wanted to get away from the whole crowd.
Well, fine. Now, we really should get back to you. According to my outline here, after you got out of the Army, you went to work for Fisk Rubber.
Yeah, I got out. I had a friend who knew a friend in Fisk Rubber Company. And so we called him up and said, a young fellow just got out of the Army, college graduate, needs a job. So this fellow said, well, send him up here and we'll either make him or break him. So I went up there and I started in at the bottom of the ladder. Actually, down there, when crude rubber came in, and I learned that, went up and actually made automobile tires on the tire book for maybe nearly a year. Then one day I was asked if I'd like to go into the laboratory, which of course I was glad to get promotion, a better job.
Let me back up. Fisk Rubber was, I can remember Fisk Rubber.
It's one of the big five in those days.
I don't know whether they're still in business.
The trademark is they're owned by the U.S. Rubber, mm-hmm. who bought out.
How large was Fisk Rubber when you joined them?
It was one of the big five. We made 32,000 tires a day, 32,000 in a 2 day, made 12,000 bicycle tires a day. Made, I don't know how many, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 hard rubber battery casings. Made most anything that had to do automotive.
And you started out down on the production line?
I went into the laboratory, went in first, and just doing routine analyses of the things that came in. And from that, went into quality control. And then I went into compounding, and there were three of us chaps about the same level, just out of been in the Army. Two of us had been in the Army and one hadn't. He had been there first. When the chief chemist told the one of his reports, the board, that through the research they had found the alpha and the omega in the accelerators, and he didn't think it was necessary to do any more research. And I think they fired him on the spot.
You mean the board didn't agree with this assessment?
And we three cubs were called up, and I remember Harry Fisk, he said, he'd take a gamble, he says, I think that's the word he used, you cubs think you can handle that job for a while? If you want, if you think you can, why, we'll give you all the help you can want in the way of advisors or experienced people that you can hire in with you and whatnot. So we think you kind of split the job up in quality and control and manufacturing and going out in the field and checking on quality and all that. So we had quite an experience there for quite a while.
Now, was Harry Fisk the president?
He was secretary. He was treasurer.
Treasurer.
He was treasurer.
He
was of the Fisk family,
Fisk
yes.
Fisk family.
Yeah.
Went back further than that then?
That was about all I ever knew about it. I think I met him just a few times.
Okay.
But he gave us boys a start.
But you were the... You were then, at that time, you were the scientific staff.
Yes, that's right. We were the whole business. We had quality. We had control of quality, control of service. And we did all the compounding.
Sorry, Bill, the mic is picking up that plastic that you have under your hand.
They're kicking up a little static?
It's not.
I see.
I can just hear it a little bit. It doesn't matter much anymore.
Yeah.
I was going to ask...
Through that, we all three of us got a great deal of general experience of the art of rubber compounding. And I say it was art because an awful lot of it was trial and error all the way through.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that precise question. When you got into the rubber compounding business, let's say, what was the understanding of polymers at that time? Were you aware of the molecular nature of what polymers were?
We got into that time. I don't think the word polymer was known. Wasn't in use.
This would have been 1920.
That was 1919. It was the beginning of the use of organic materials. Previous to that time, about the only accelerators were lead, several lead oxides, blue lead, white lead, red lead. But then the first accelerator came was red oil. They called it, aniline.
Did you have any... That was a theoretical understanding, if I say, about what natural rubber was and what the curing did.
Well, about all they knew was that you had to have sulfur. And you could even out a lot of quality and using a little stearic acid and zinc oxide. And we had Lothar Weber, who was supposed to be know more about the chemistry of rubber, and I say the chemistry, I put chemistry in quotes because it wasn't much chemistry. He was supposed to be the leading man, in the world. And we had him, he came down, he was in Cambridge, and he would come down and spend Friday afternoons with us, the three of us, going over our qualities.
Now, Weber was a consultant for...
Yes, he was a consultant.
Was he in the chemistry department at Harvard?
No, I don't think so. I think he was... I don't know what his background was. Mm-hmm. His father had been known, internationally known, as a rubber chemist, and that goes back. And every time I say rubber chemist, I say it reservedly because there was darn little chemistry to it. It was mostly art based on experience, trial and error.
Well, let's see, the sulfur cure was, goes back to Charles.
That's Goodyear discovery.
Can you remember when that
Was it 1880 or something so like that? 1880.
So by that time, there was nearly 40 years or so of background.
Yes, and all we had was
rubber.
All we knew about curing rubber, which needed sulfur, a little stearic acid was good, and zinc oxide was good. That's about all you knew.
Of the reinforcing properties that the black men discovered?
We used to use zinc oxide and clay as reinforcing. Then black carbon black came in. I remember very much when the first carbon black came in, and we'd heard about it, and with trepidation substituted 17 parts by volume of carbon black in our automobile tire treads, and wondered how it would go. And previous to that time, the Fisk tire was a very famous tire. It was a zinc oxide tire, a zinc oxide tread colored with iron oxide. You give it the red top.
Oh, I see.
Just a little bit of iron oxide and it gave it a red color.
I think I've seen pictures of some of those old tires, but I didn't realize.
That's what it was. There were a lot of tires that were white treads. And then they began to put a little bit of black in it.
Let's take a break here. I'm at the end of tape again, while I'm changing the tape.
You know what?
I really got to get the suit of bear attire story
That's really important, but there were personalities that wanted the special attire. So as we would have to have a mold made, engraved, and as I say, we just taking an example, we made the mold for Theda Bear, and as the tire went down the road, and if it happened to hit a little moisture, he would print Theda Bear, Theda Bear, Theda Bear in the road. As I recall it, it was a green tread with a yellow sidewall. We made them for Fairbanks, I remember. There were a number of people, that, particularly the movie picture people, that wanted something very special.
This was, now we're talking about the early 1920s.
Oh, yes, early 1920s.
She was a silent movie star, as I recall.
That's right.
Bear,
that's right.
Now, when did you, can you recall about what year the carbon black came in and you started using that?
Oh, must have been very early 20s, 22, somewhere in there.
I heard a tale that Goodyear, I think it was, the story I heard was that he was trying to make a real cheap tire, so he put in some ground shells or some carbon black or something just to reduce the volume of rubber, and was surprised to discover the reinforcing properties.
There have been some tires made with clay. People have tried to use clay as a reinforcement, but that didn't work out very well. It was difficult. If you put enough clay in to get good reinforcement, it's very hard to get it to adhere to the carcass of your tire. Then zinc oxide was adopted, and that worked out very well. And then the carbon black came out. And as I recall, the first carbon black tread I ever saw was, seems to me, it was made by Republic Tire Company in Pennsylvania, and it was called a Barefoot, B-A-R-E, Barefoot, and because it was quite a soft tread, but it improved the wear, and they began increasing, and of course now they use a great deal more carbon black than even they did when I was there. In fact, I think after I got out of it, the use of it greatly increased. And then synthetic rubber came along, and more and more was used, not to dilute the rubber, but for reinforcing
and
wear.
Definitely a part of the composition. Okay, so then you went from Fisk to DuPont.
Yes.
You mentioned to me privately that
we were.
How that happened.
This anhydrofumaraldehyde paraterlewidine, we were. That this chap had made that I was telling about that had the alpha and the omega, he thought that was it. Well, anyway, we were buying that from Atlantic Dye Stuffs in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And DuPont was getting into the organic chemical trade, and one of their salesmen, who was Warren Kinsman, came up and talked to our purchasing agent. They liked some of the business, and so we agreed to, I guess, split the business and take some from DuPont. And one of the early shipments came in there. I guess I told you this, but it came in drums and nothing but press cake. Open the drum, tip it over, and the water would run out. That spoiled the Christmas for us three chaps. We stayed there and tried to wangle through and get that in shape so we could use enough of it to to get us by until it was replaced. Of course, that was very embarrassing to DuPont. But then, several years later, when we were still doing, we of course began to buy more and more of DuPont products. But now, one day, Ernest Bridgewater, who was then representing DuPont, told one of the fellow named Cliff Sanderson that they were looking for somebody with experience in tires, general rubber compound, and they'd like to have to come to Wilmington to see if there were any of the products they had in Dye Works, which it was then called, could be used in the rubber business, and who would be able to service chemicals if they had them. And one of the other chaps, he said he didn't want to come down because he wanted to stay with Fisk. So that left me, and so they asked me if I'd come down. And I didn't know much about DuPont. I remember going home and asking my wife if she'd like to go down to DuPont, and she said, "Who's DuPont?" Which was the general attitude around New England. Nobody had heard of DuPont. Well, so I came down here and went to the rubber laboratory, which consisted of just, there was one other fellow there that he'd had some experience in rubber, but they wanted him to go out to Chicago in sales. So he went out there, and he was from Lee Rubber Company, and he went out there, and I sort of took over, and that was in 1926. Well, I hadn't been there too long when...
I had a question about the rubber lab, but at one point I saw that it was listed as having been started in 1922.
Yes, it was started in
1926.
I went there in 1926. No, rubber lab was operating. There again, my memory just fades to a chap who. I wish I could think of his name. But anyway, he was later hired by a group from, I think it was from Goodyear. My memory is really, since I had this stroke, I can't remember.
Let me go back.
But anyway, it embarrasses me terribly that I can't remember the names or anything.
We can always dig it out if we want while we're editing.
This chap went into a rubber service laboratories in Akron, Ohio, and he went out and worked with them, and it was a rubber service laboratory. They sold recipes, they sold processes and whatnot, and they was the first one, and then the laboratory was the same with to the it was a chap I just can't remember the name, because the first one after this fellow went to Rubber Service Laboratory went to New York City as a salesman, and he was followed by this chap, Weller, who came from Lee Rubber, and when he went to Chicago and I came in and I took over, and then not long after I was there we began to find chemicals that could be used and colors and all that different things, and we began to expand. And we hired more and more people.
When you came to the rubber lab, what kind of... Hello. When you came to rubber lab, how many people did you have working with you?
Of course, I was alone as a compound for a short time. And Paul Sullivan, I think there were three or four in the laboratory during... Just testing work.
you mentioned something a little while ago that gave me a thought or a question that's been in my mind. Were the compounding recipes proprietary? Each company had its own?
I'd say a typical recipe for an automobile tire would be based on 100 parts of rubber, 5 parts of zinc oxide, 3 to 5 parts of stearic acid, and then we put in maybe 40 or 50 parts of carbon black and same amount of zinc oxide, and that was about it. In the early days, our inner tube was made of 100 parts of rubber, 10 parts of sulfur, period. Then later on, they began to put some organic accelerators in and speed up the vulcanization. And, of course, those are the days when the inner tube was made on a circular mandrel and stripped off and then buffed, the ends were buffed, and painted on the rubber cement and painted with a little sulfur chloride is stuck together, and you just hope to God the thing would last as long as it could put into a tire.
You said you found some organic chemicals from the dye works that were...
Of course, they had this anhydro from Paris fluidine, and then we found that through Ressler and Heslacher, we knew that... which was available to us, hexamethylene, tetramine, and then we got in and found the difenyl-guanidine the same time Dow was getting into it. It became highly competitive that way. And I think the real find that we had was phenylalphanephthylamine, which is an antioxidant. And that was a big part. And then we found that you could buck that up by adding some other materials to it.
Did you get patents out of this work, or was this all?
Patents were taken on secondary means, like diphenylamine. Goodrich also came out with phenyl beta naphthylamine. We had phenyl alpha naphthylamine, and we had some adjustment being made on that. But they were mostly commonplace organic accelerators. Good aniline, everybody knew that aniline and mixed with amines. Well, aniline is amine, but with an aldehyde, you got there was a whole series, a long series of accelerators made. Amine and aldehyde combinations.
Did you get into peptizing agents?
Oh, yes.
Rubber and so on?
Yeah, that came along, peptizing agents. That was the work of Ira Williams. And he was the fellow that really got into the peptizing. And he was a pioneer in that.
What was the Chambers' work like in those days when you first came?
Well, it was a hodgepodge, I'll tell you, if there ever was a hodgepodge of pipes and smells. And
was it the largest organic chemicals plant in the United States at that time?
Yeah, yes, it was. It was. And some of the memories of that, we used to go over in the old days, over on the ferry, back and forth, and then you had to get off the ferry up there and walk pretty nearly half a mile down the seawall, and it was pretty tough going there on a cold day with the wind blowing off that river.
I remember tales of that. The bridge was built just before I got here.
Yeah.
You couldn't persuade Dorothy to live in Pensgrove?
No, she was glad to live over here.
You had advice from somebody that would be too bad.
Mm-hmm.
We had advice from some friend that you would do better if you stayed in Wilmington.
Yes, I was going to.
Well, I guess most of the technical people, at least, seem to have lived in Wilmington and taken the ferry over. Is that right?
Yes, they did. Yes, there was.
It was. Early in the morning, getting up,
Say, what was the college where, that Sally went to? What was the college that Sally attended?
Beloit.
Beloit.
Oh, Beloit. Yeah. Wisconsin, yeah.
Okay.
In Northern.
Yeah.
Would you like to have a tea, or am I getting in there? Is this being recorded? I have coffee at the moment. Oh, synthetic
canal. Tea is fine. Thank you. Well, I see you had the dye works. Tetraethyl lead was...
Yeah. You see, when I first came to the dye works on this job, the rubber lab was not known, that it was not a separate entity. We were a part of technical laboratory, yes. And my boss was Dr. Rose. And I worked with him, and when I went in there to report to him, he said, Hayden, I don't know the first thing about rubber. You don't know the first thing about dyes. Let's call it quits. You tend to your end, and I'll tend to my end. If you get in trouble, let me know. I'll try to haul you out. That was my introduction. Incident, do you ever know him? Because he was a very fine man.
I recognize the name, but yeah. I think he must have gone on to better things by the time I got there. This was, you were part of technical laboratory.
Yeah. I was part of tech lab.
Okay, then, let's see. DuPont must have gotten into the tetraethyl lead.
Well, they were in it when I came,
yeah.
In a small way. And one of the, I remember one or two of the rubber chemists over, and the people in rubber chemicals at Jackson Laboratory had been in lead tetraethyl and had been transferred over there to get out of it because some of them had been, had a little touch of lead poisoning, I guess.
I think Fritz Downing had been...
Fritz Downing
had gotten his lifetime exposure to lead or something like that.
Fritz was one, and that was... Names just escaped me. I could see them in my mind.
They do, too. In fact, I was going to bring over a picture that I was of the technical staff at Jackson Laboratory taken in 1951. To see how many of the people in there you've recognized,
yeah.
Because I knew most of these people, but I couldn't recognize, I can't call
well,
them names.
You know, but, yes, I suppose Fritz, there's a whole lot of those fellows
came
over.
Well, I was going to come back, in fact, some of these names I'll be bringing up later, perhaps. What did you have close interaction between Jackson Lab and... the technical laboratory, or
oh yes, I was much closer to Jackson Lab than I was with the tech lab, because they were doing a lot of work over there in rubber chemicals, and I was working with those people over there, Bill Calcutt and Don Powers and the chaps working on rubber chemicals, and so I spent much more time with them.
The Newport Chemical Company been acquired then?
No, that was considerably much later.
Okay, well now, without skipping over the neoprene story entirely, I think you've written about this, and I have, I think we have a pretty good understanding of how you got involved first with neoprene. Let me ask, were you were really the person, principally though, who learned how to morph and compound it and make it, and come up with recipes that...
Yeah, surely, Mm-hmm. Another reason I found out from the very first piece that he ever had that I had used rosin and then used magnesia, and I found that those were quite essential. You could use a zinc oxide in place of magnesia, but you got into trouble because it was vulcanized so fast.
Oh, really? And
it's much more active. And
chemically, what did the oxides do? Did they react with the chlorine, or did
I suppose? I always suppose that's what happened. But, and of course, carbon black was essential because that to control it.
Let me ask a broad question that might lead us in the other direction. What, quite aside from, including, but not necessarily restricted to things in science, What do you think your major contributions were?
Oh, I don't know. Well, of course, I think the first thing was finding out what the essential things you had, what the things you needed for processing and vulcanization, which is, let's say, is rosin and magnesia. But after that, of course, in the compounding and leading a group of men to compound for specific purposes. For example, compounding for covering of secondary distribution electrical power line. You'd go down, in those early days, you'd go down the road here where they were distributing power, and you'd see the rubber insulation streaked off, hanging by flopping in the wind. And that was one of the first things, because we found that neoprene was very resistant to sunlight if it was compounded with carbon black. And that's, I think, one of the very first experiments we ever made was at Roebling, was to cover a wire with a neoprene composition. But then you were compounding for that particular job. Of course, you had to add softeners for extrusion purposes and various compounding ingredients to give some special use. But and you had compounding for side walls of tires, which is also has always been a good use. And then you had the compounding for automotive parts and the rubber parts that go around an automobile, hose to carry solvents, hundreds of different products. We had to think about what to use and try to compound something that could be used.
At the same time, of course, it was the research and development on the manufacture, the polymerization of chloroprene. Were you involved in that directly? Or
only the evaluation of the products that they brought out. Mm-hmm. For example, as you know, the first neoprene was made in 5-gallon bottles, chloroprene put in 5-gallon bottles, subjected to Cooper Hewitt lights.
Yes.
And you'd run until you got a syrup, then you'd drown it with alcohol, pull out the polymerized product that was still kind of elastic, and clean that up. And then
did the people who were doing the work on polymerization understand what they were doing in terms of did they have any concept that this was a free radical?
Well, I think Ira Williams did.
Ira Williams?
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that was a name I saw it in the literature, but I didn't really know who he was.
No, Ira Williams came to us.
He was an organic chemist, was he?
He came to us from Grisselli.
Mm-hmm.
And put together an accelerator, 808 and 833, were two accelerators that he had produced. They were aldehyde amine products. But when he got there and he got a hold of some neoprene, got to working with that, he really got into that. He loved it and worked at it. I think he knew what he was doing.
And then he got back into the polymerization.
Yeah.
So he came to you first to do curing, or
He was assigned to us in rubber because he had been working on rubber chemicals for Grisselli in Cleveland.
Yeah.
So it was just a natural. He came and worked into rubber at Jackson Laboratory. We worked very close with him.
Did. Okay, let's see. I think it was, if I recall correctly, it was Howard Starkweather who did the first emulsion, the first successful emulsion polymerization.
Well, Howard, yes. Howard Starkweather worked with Carruthers for a while. And, yes, Howard contributed a great deal.
Well, I guess... You probably didn't talk in those days about free radical polymerization, and chain transfer agents.
Never heard of it.
Molecular weights.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I said that Haverstock, where they contributed a great deal to the study of polymerization. I think he knew what he was doing. He and Ira Williams put those two fellows in it. And of course, there was another chap there in Jackson Lab that was pretty much into it too.
I have a list of those names that we might come back to later. Right. I'll be asking you about some of them. Let's see, you were involved, I guess, pretty heavily with neoprene then, from the rubber lab point of view anyway, for several years.
Yes, until 41.
Until 41, right.
When they built the plant in Louisville.
Yes.
And I came over to Wilmington.
Were there other things going on at that time that were important in your mind?
Well, of course, there were these other polymers that were coming along. Bitone and... one of the most interesting pieces of rubber... they got one around here, but it's called adiprene.
Right. In fact, I have a list.
I don't know.
I have a list of the other.
Remember those? I think I've got a piece of that adiprene around here somewhere.
Okay. Let's take your mic off.
Oh.
You don't get tangled up there. All right. Bill, let me switch to kind of a brief history of your career at DuPont, and then we'll come back to some of the details. According to my records, you were headed rubber lab at the Chambers Works
from 26 to 41.
26 to 41.
Yeah.
And then you went to Wilmington as assistant manager of rubber chemicals.
Yeah, division of Orchem.
Okay, we're back on the air now.
All right.
About 1954, you were assistant director of sales.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1956, special assistant to sales for Elastomer Chemical Department.
Yeah.
Right.
I always felt that I was really mostly more like a technical sales manager than anything else, the kind of work that I was doing at that time.
Okay, let's see, after you...
I had some concern, this needn't be in this here at all, but I had some concern actually about that time. You see, I was working with Ernest Bridgewater, and he was two or three years younger than I, and I was his assistant. And Jack Daly was general manager, and I went to Jack and I said, "Listen, you got to do something about this organization, because here I am as Ernest's assistant, would be the man you might logically want to push along if you ever moved Ernest up." And so you got to find somebody that really that ought to be his assistant that could move on up, because I'm older than he is. I'll be going out of here before he is. Therefore, I think you ought to do something about it. Well, that's what started all that thing, and then I became an assistant. That's what happened.
Well, I mean, that's all pertinent information.
And I felt very strongly about that. I shouldn't keep that spot, because... if something happened to him, I was too old.
I'm going to stop at this point because we're near the end of the tape, and it'll be easiest just to change it now. Okay. I guess would be correct to say that. I don't think it's correct to say. After your neoprene work in the rubber lab and so on, what other important things were happening in that period over Chambers Works with you?
Well, with me, of course, I still had to spend a lot of time at the Chambers Works back in the days of handling both rubber chemicals as they were made and being sure that we had the proper quality of rubber chemicals and making what the industry wanted, and the same was true of organizing a quality group in Louisville that would maintain the quality, day-to-day quality of neoprene as it was made, because that was very, very important. So that was all under the same control, the same group. Although that came under manufacturer, we felt responsible for the personnel there and the quality of the work they were doing.
Did somewhere along in there you built a separate rubber laboratory and split off from
the technical lab? In Akron, yes. That was built as a service laboratory in Akron, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And it was manned with experienced people both from here and from industry.
Don't I recall that when I was there, rubber laboratory was a separate from technical lab?
Yes, that broke off. I forget just what year it was. It became a rubber chemicals division when that was established as a rubber chemical division, a separate division rather than any part of Orchem.
Right.
And that time the laboratory was set up independent.
Okay. Now, I made a list of some of the polymeric products and inventions that DuPont commercialized subsequent to neoprene.
That's all after my day. I don't know.
I was just questioning whether you had anything to do with butacite resin or sheeting.
No,
was over in the...
not one bit, no.
...ammonia department.
Right, yes, that's right.
How about... But being in the rubber lab, you're probably familiar with Cordura rayon tire cord.
Well, yes, but the only our interest in that was in the adhesive that was put on the cord so that the rubber or nip or whatever you're going to use would stick to the cord, but with this adhesive.
So the textile fibers was developing that, I guess.
Yes, yes.
They worked with you, though, to...
Well, did a lot of evaluation work on it, yeah. But they worked with industry quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. How about Teflon?
Teflon had nothing to do with Teflon. That was with the Freon group.
Right, and you.
No, we never.
They were pretty separate.
Never
the
had.
Dyes and the
we never had anything to do with that.
Rubber. Chemicals.
That's right. Rubber chemicals never had anything to do with it.
I recall, though, people in the Jackson lab, people jumped back and forth from group to group a bit. Some of the dye chemists ended up in the rubber programs, didn't they?
Well, if I could see a list of names, I could probably tell you who did what, but pick them out of my memory isn't much good.
You did mention Adaprene earlier.
Oh, yes. Adaprene, you saw it there. That was a good product. The only trouble with it was that it's difficult to get something to adhere to it. And secondly, it would fail under heat.
Yes.
For example, you perhaps heard the classical where they had built some tires and Adaprene tread. It wore wonderfully until they made a panic stop and then...
No. I was in the Adaprene task force when I first came here in 1953-54, and until it was until the project was killed.
An awfully good product. We just kept it. Well, that piece there, I don't know how many years old it is, but it's about as good as it was when it was made.
That was a
Well, I remember talking with Harold Alley. He had invited us over, a bunch of the young chemists over for lunch one day, just about at the end of that. And, I guess the main thing he was commenting about was that when they'd started that out, the price of natural rubber and GRS was something like 20, 25 cents a pound.
Oh, yeah. Well, rubber.
No, it was 50 cents a pound, I think, maybe. And it was going down.
Well, natural rubber was 3 cents a pound when we tried to get into the market.
And when was this?
About 32.
32, okay. Neoprene was...
2.5.
We were going to compete with natural rubber.
Yeah. I think neoprene cost us $5, and we sold it for 2.5, and rubber was selling at three and a half cents.
Well, the adiprene story, were you much involved with that? Or
only in evaluating it.
No. I don't suppose DuPont ever recovered its investment in that project.
I doubt it.
They finally got some polyurethane products out of it in the isocyanates business. So that was a failure.
I remember the urethane.
Yeah. How about Hypalon?
Hypalon came over to us from the experimental station, and with it was name gone. And at first, it was a very, very difficult process, very difficult process. And until you had something that you could process on conventional rubber machinery, you wouldn't get the industry to accept it.
Uh-huh.
And that was all when they finally, and then when they got, about the time that I left, they were beginning to get into improving the quality of it so that it could be handled and processed. And now I guess it's really a good commodity.
I haven't been or seen much about it. Still,
so it was just in the early days of evaluation.
Yeah.
If you got it into a product, it was very, very efficient. It had a lot of very good qualities. But at the time that I left, it was still impossible to really to process it.
How about, of course... Lacquer spandex fiber came out of the polyurethane research eventually, but that was fibers.
Yes, but you see, that we had practically nothing to do with that.
How about Nordel hydrocarbon rubber? That was...
I don't know. That's, again, you see, these things are mostly after my day.
The research was going on in that while you were...
Yes, I know of Nordel, but it was not an important factor at all.
Okay, you, going back a bit, you made a European trip to IG Farben and ICI in 1936, and I have looked
that's
through...
That's all right. Did you ever see my report?
Yeah, I looked through your report.
I think in that folder there that I gave you there, I think is a carbon copy of the report that I submitted.
I have the report, and I did look through it, and...
Well, yeah, that looks like it.
It raised some interesting questions. First, how did this trip come about?
The Germans very obviously knew they wanted to prepare for war. And they knew that they ought to, if they were going to, in the war, that they had to have a rubber. And they couldn't very well depend on natural rubber. They couldn't hoard enough to carry him through any intensive war. And they knew how to make butadiene products, but where were they going to get the raw material? Their oil wasn't available, but they had plenty of coal. And when they heard that we were making coal from acetylene, their ears popped right up, and they wanted to make a swap. They wanted to swap their butadiene styrene rubber for, they're willing to make some kind of a commercial swap. If they could have neoprene, we could have the butadiene. So I went over there to demonstrate to them the quality of neoprene, see what you could do with neoprene, and to be, take a good look at their butadiene product. Mm-hmm. That's why I went over there into Germany. Of course, I also went over into England and made the whole round of all the rubber companies over there selling them neoprene, what they could do with it.
From this report, you actually went in and compounded with them and helped them evaluate.
Yes, sure. They were very cooperative, very cooperative.
What was your feeling about the political atmosphere then as far as you went over?
Well,
you went over on the German ship, the Bremen.
We went over on the German ship. Dorothy was with me. Uh-huh. And we were treated very, very well. Of course, they wanted something, you see. And they really wined us and dined us and all that. I'm sure it didn't have a damn bit of influence on me, but I think, well, I met the president of E.G. Farben and his wife entertained in his home, which is an unheard of thing, really, because the home life of most any of the Germans is pretty private. Uh-huh. But anyway, we were put up in the casino in Leverkusen, which was a place where they entertained their people. Very, very nice place, very nice accommodation. We had anything in the way of food that would even think of, and yet people didn't have it outside, except that we did have the Eintopfessen. That is, once a week you had just one pot or whatever it is, usually a bowl of heavy soup of some sort, or what we'd call a beef stew or something like that. And the difference between what it would cost to provide a regular meal and the Eintopfessen was supposed to go into charity, the winter help, they called it. That was what you saw from the point of view from the inside. Of course, we had got to know some of the workings of the people. One of the things I'll always remember, they asked me if I'd like to go down to and have lunch with the work people. So I sure, yes, I'd like to do it. So we went in, we sat down at a long table on a bench, and they brought out a herring, raw herring. They'd stripped the skin off the thing, and it sat there, head on, eyes looking up at you, and a big piece of bread and a stein of beer, and that was your lunch. Well, I'd never eaten raw fish before. That's a little rough to take, but just as an example, always glad I did it. I remember, and Dorothy remembers this, when she got to know some of the people there a lot better than I did, particularly the wives. And there was one wife of the head of this whole rubber works. What was his name? I can't think of it. But anyway, his wife had been through and knew something of what war was, the First World War. And she used to say, my wife talked book German very well. I could understand a good deal of German and talk a little bit in those days. She was terrified that war was coming on. And she had her family been wiped out in the First World War. She had a boy and a girl, and she just couldn't face the fact that they were going to be cannon fodder. And she often cried on Dorothy's shoulders what was ahead of them. Well, what was the man's name, Dot, that was, Dot? Who was the man who was ahead of that work at the rubber? Hair director, what? His wife was your friend over there. I can't hear her.
Was it at Leverkusen or the...
At Leverkusen. The director there. Well, I didn't know his name immediately if you mentioned it. should be right up in the start there. Yeah, Fritz Tamara, he was the managing director that I told you about we met. And the manager, Leverkuhn, was Kieran. I met him, Stang and Associate, Conrad, Herr Director Dr. Conrad, Eric Conrad. He was the fellow. Well, we were in the middle of the night, we were in bed, and we heard this bang on the door like you'd taken a cane and bang on the door. And I knew this fellow, Conrad, had been working with him. We were very familiar, working day after day. But I got up and I was put on the bathroom, went to the door. Heil Hitler! He stood there just like a statue, clicked his heels, and Heil Hitler. And he says, Winter help. And never he didn't recognize me at all. And he put out his hand and wanted money. Said, this goes to Hitler's winter help for the poor people. And he was dressed as a brown charter, brown uniform, boots, the whole thing. Just absolutely transformed from the man that I knew in daytime in the laboratories. And this. Another instance.
And now, was this the...
This was the Leverkusen.
This was the man whose wife was...
Yes, and it was his wife that was so terribly concerned about it, and talked to Dorothy that, of course, just between the two girls, so to speak.
And go on, you were going to mention something.
Well, these other people are all people that I knew very well. Heubaum and Pohl, Sterklin, Koch, Lechlein. They were all nice chaps. I'm sure they were all Nazis except Koch. And I'm sure he wasn't, because he was terrified what was going to happen. And he confided a lot in me about it. I'll come back to him later on. Yes. Another incident that we were in Munich. We went over to Munich for a weekend, Dorothy and I. And in the middle of the night, we heard this crunch, 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 crunch of soldiers, of steps. We heard the clatter, clatter, clatter of hoofs. We heard the rattling of harnesses and the turning of heavy wheels on cobblestone. We looked out the window, and as far as you could see were troops, artillery, horse-drawn, all no motorized. It was the March on the Rhine. I immediately got dressed and went down to the desk. What's going on here? Nobody knew. I came upstairs and I said to Dora, get yourself into some clothes and pick up our bags. We're going to leave. So in the morning we got up, we got down, went to the railroad station, took the first train to Paris, opened the newspaper that I bought on the street. Nazis had moved on to the Rhine. A little later on, I had a friend over there that was a friend here and I had worked with in at Fisk Rubber Company, and he was the plant manager for the Engelbert Rubber Company in Aachen, Germany. We went over there to spend a weekend with him, and one day I was in the plant with him, and I was, of course, selling to the Engelbert Rubber Company our products, and Engelbert having been always been a very good customer. And afterwards, we were still there. Everybody had gone, and this chap, Mel, said to me, Bill, he said, I want to show you something. He says, come on. We walked out into the middle of the factory there at the German plant of the Engelbert Rubber Company, pulls up a trap door and he says, let's go down. It was stocked with food, water. He says the whole Rhine Valley around here, people could go underground and stay underground. It's simply a war preparation. It should be the equivalent of bomb-proof shelter. Well, the upshot was, Dorothy and I came home from Europe just feeling certain that war was going to break out. So you asked me what I saw, what...
Well, that was precisely the question, because I think...
Those three incidents...
I was getting very, very, very concerned about and very interested in foreign affairs at that time, and my recollection was hazy, but I'm sure by 36 or 37...
Oh, it was obvious.
The U.S. public must have been aware that they were gearing up for war.
They were aware of it, but casually aware of it, I think.
Yeah, that must have hit you with considerable...
Oh, it did. We came back. We were just shaken up about it. It was just so obvious that the war was about to come.
You mentioned being in Munich, and I was looking at part of your itinerary.
Yeah. Then we went to Berchtesgaden.
Yeah, it's spelled here Berchtesgaden, B-E-R-T-H-E.
Yeah. That's it. That's up in the German Alps.
That's where Hitler had his...
It was, and very interestingly, while we were there, we stayed in a place called the Kurhaus, as I remember, which was a very nice residential sanitarium, I guess you might call it. It's beautiful surroundings, beautiful Alps around there, and he had his so-called eagle nest. One day, a day or so after we got there, there was a courier came down and presented Herr Hitler's
compliments.
Your compliments. And regretted that he couldn't invite us up to the Eagle Nest, but his schedule was such that he wasn't able to invite us up during the short stay that we'd planned to be there.
So your visit was that important to them?
They wanted that neoprene.
There was some trouble later. Antitrust investigations or congressional hearings? Did that pertain
I was not involved at all.
IG Farben visit or?
Well, I was never involved in that
else.
In any way at all. No. I saw Hitler there once, though, when I was while I was at Leverkusen. We did some of our work with the Continental Gummi Fabriken in Hanover. And I was in Hanover one time when it was said we going to be a big deal. Everybody has to assemble out in the main atrium, which being I think five or six floors, but they all had balconies around each, and you looked down. Herr Hitler came in and delivered a speech. I couldn't understand what he spoke. Yeah. He spoke because it was a Plattdeutsch, and he spoke rapidly.
Yeah.
But I saw the man. I saw him go through the commotion motions.
Were you impressed?
Not particularly, no. I just thought it was somebody ranting. I didn't know much about who Hitler was at that time. I kept hearing, because Heil Hitler, everybody you saw was Heil Hitler, Heil Hitler.
What was your feeling during this visit about the quality of the IG Farben and the German industry in general compared to
Well, tip top. Couldn't help me be impressed with it. The plant wasn't too different to the old dye works. I mean, just a hodgepodge of various operations. But still, the people that I talked to, I thought were very high quality, competent, technical men.
You commented in your report about the cleanliness of some of the compounding laboratories.
And, oh, yes.
Places that you visited.
Places you worked. Of course, I was always kind of a bear that you can't do good work in a sloppy place.
Uh-huh.
And they used to think that was a little rough on the boys. You should think sometimes at the laboratory. I'd complain if things weren't just spick and span, because I felt that you do good work, you you had to have a good place to work in. Be careful. Clean. One of the things we did over there was, you've heard of the German Autobahn.
Yes.
We built tires and took them out on the Autobahn. It was a day very much like this. Rainy, cold, and we ran those tires on the Autobahn to, we ran them 100 kilometers an hour speed, 120. I think we got up to about 120, which would be, about 70 miles an hour. Those tires got so hot that you could, that when you stop, you see the steam come right off. That was one of the troubles, of course, with neoprene, that,
yes.
You know, they heat up.
Well, yeah. They gave you quite a bit of information on the various Bunas, Buna S.
Buna S was butadiene styrene, and the other was
butadiene
nitrile. Yes, that's right. Well, that was a very tough one, and that's the one that was very, very oil resistant. Very oil resistant. And butadiene styrene needed to have a lot of work done on processing, which was done when we got the our government just confiscated the patent, so to speak. We started making it during the war.
Okay, that was that goes on to some questions about I see there were some IG patents on emulsion polymerization.
I had nothing. I wasn't involved in that.
Some
anyway.
Comment there that. That
no, I think the one to comment on that would be Starkweather, and he's gone.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to. We're getting into some of your public involvement. Then, according to something I picked up, Hayden and Bridgewater testified before the Baruch Committee in August 1942.
Yes, that was on the need of a synthetic rubber,
right.
Particularly the need of, you had to have a certificate of necessity to get the materials to make build a plant. And of course we wanted to build, we saw a need and wanted to build a plant. Our plant was to be 10,000 ton production. And we had a place in Louisville, Louisville being have plenty of limestone, plenty of coal, and had an agreement with, because Louisville Gas and Electric for power, they would take care of the power that we would need. We could make our own acetylene and go ahead and produce the chloroprene.
You made everything then at Louisville,
yep.
to make the acetylene?
Yeah.
Later, we bought some acetylene from carbide down there.
Yes, yes.
At Louisville.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the initial plant didn't involve
that's right.
Carbide?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think we made our own. I remember it. Now, wait a minute. Let me back up on that. I think we bought the... yes, that's right. We made the HCl and we bought the carbide. We bought the acetylene, that's
the acetylene,
right. Yeah, we bought the acetylene and we made the we made the HCl, that's right. Then we put the acetylene in. And
now what? All I know is that we were buying carbide.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. And then we went up to Marquette there up near in Michigan.
Montague, Michigan.
There we bought, that was sitting right on a salt dome.
Okay, that was for the HCl.
That's where
they tried to run, or did run, the arc acetylene
right,
process.
Right, and we bought our HCl.
Okay, Bill, talking about the neoprene plant at Louisville, as we were earlier, the government took that over during the war.
Yeah.
We operated it.
Yes.
So the government bought it back.
Yeah, they took over our plant and added three more to it. In other words, it turned out 40,000 instead of 10.
Yeah. Okay. Were you involved at all in the Redmond River project during the war?
No.
Or did DuPont stay purposely aloof from that?
Well, I had nothing to do with it in general. We were involved, of course, with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and the Rubber Commission, which they worked very closely with them with the establishing the plant and the money and all contracts and the development of the relations between the government and ourselves. But that was... But as far as the rubber allocations of rubber itself, no.
I see. In 1952, you went on the for a time on the Office of Price Stabilization.
Oh yeah, Mike. What was his name? He had been mayor of Toledo. Mike DeSalles.
Oh.
Was the head of the Office of Price Administration, OPA. Mm-hmm. And a number of people from industry had been asked, I guess the rubber chemical manufacturing organization had been asked to supply some men to go down there, head up various divisions in the pricing of chemicals. And I was given the assigned to the pricing of aliphatic chemicals.
Right. Okay, yeah, we have a copy of, that was after Galbraith had left and so on, right? So you didn't run into him?
The only one of any political importance that I had anything to do with was Mike DeSalles.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've indicated, alluded earlier, the fact that you did a lot of work with the ASTM.
Oh yeah,
standards and so on. That was an important contribution.
Well, I did a lot of work with them. I enjoyed it. Standardization of.
You were 50 years with the American Chemical Society.
Yes.
Any other professional organizations that you were particularly active in?
No, I think the ASTM and the ACS were the only two that I was ever much interested in.
So your contributions to the rubber business and DuPont are a large number of years involved in the marketing and product quality and that sort of thing.
That's right.
Anything that really stands out in your mind about this part of your career?
No, because I love people. And I love to mingle with people and to be with people. And I think that one of the biggest contributions that I had with our particular organization was holding it all together through thick and thin. There was some of the times that some of the boys got terribly discouraged, or somebody got their nose out of joint, or personnel things that I enjoyed very much. And I think I did have a large contribution to our organization in making a team out of it and making the thing gel, making it work, keeping the gears lubricated and meshed. And then you can carry that one step further. I think that's what happened in my work with ASTM, and as closest it worked with the ASC. And the ASME, as a matter of fact, to get the two together instead of sitting across the table and like two cats ready to spring at each other, get them where they're working together. And I think we accomplished a great deal in that respect and made a lot of progress.
Talking about people, you worked with a large number of people, some of whom I'm very curious about and other people are. J. Warren Kinsman.
Yeah, well, the Warren hired me.
Yes, I remember now. He had, as I recall, no real technical background in his education.
I think he had the same kind of. He might have had. He went to. He might have had some. He went to a college in Wesley in Middletown, Connecticut.
Oh, he did.
And I think he took a liberal arts course. He was a salesman through and through.
Yeah, but he ended up as...
Oh, he was one of the vice presidents.
Plant manager and finally vice president
I don't remember much about his functions or his accomplishments as a plant manager.
He got a lot of visibility as a spokesman.
Well, yes, he was that. Well, you have to have a certain amount of egotism to go through things like he was a salesman, put it that way.
Okay, I guess he struck me, and when I knew him from a distance, as a politician.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, that's right. He was all that.
Similar.
Yeah, I liked Warren.
Yeah.
Very much.
Did you have close dealings with him, or just?
Well, I wouldn't say they were close. I felt close to him,
mm-hmm.
and we were always very friendly. And my wife was friendly with he and his wife. We were good friends, put it that way.
Jack Daly.
Oh, Jack. I worked for Jack. Jack was a straight shooter. I liked Jack very much.
Mm-hmm.
He was like old Buck Harrington. He was the first top boss that I had when I first came here. He was a kind of a grumpy, gruff sort of little fellow, but you liked him. He was a square shooter. That's the way with Jack. Jack was a square shooter. He could be tough at times, but and he was demanding, as he should be, a general manager.
The other name that you mentioned was Buck Harrington? Or?
Buck Harrington.
Harrington.
He was Willis Harrington. Willis F. Harrington. He was general manager of Arkham when I came to work.
I see.
And then he went upstairs, and Ed Robinson took his place.
I knew.
Then Jack Daly came in.
Daly seemed sort of a rough character to me. He gave Roy Arnsberger was research director, research director for Arkham. And the first year he was research director, he asked Daly to address the scientific staff at the annual meeting they had.
Well, Jack was a little rough, but he was absolute square shooter.
Yeah, well, I don't doubt.
Always knew where you stood with Jack. He got
I just remember that he gave a very downbeat kind of lecture about he wasn't sure about the future of the pump company. He wasn't sure the people were getting now were as good as they were when he came in. It was
with Jack.
Yeah. Well, he was grousing about things that people, first question they asked was, are your labs air conditioned and what are your fringe benefits? And he didn't think this was the kind of question he'd like to hear asked, I guess. Arnold Collins, of course.
Yes, he worked with Carruthers, and he was the guy that he made the first chloroprene and left it in the test tube and found the gum there in the morning.
Was he? He was from Columbia, I believe.
I'm not certain.
I'm sure of that. That was. Did you think him to be a particularly brilliant fellow, or just?
Well, I had no real way to evaluate with him. Nice as ever, chappy. He wasn't a particularly happy disposition, but I knew Arnold Collins and have no reason to really to evaluate him in any way at all.
He was very modest. I remember having talked with him. He was very modest.
He would strike you as being a very modest person, unassertive.
Yeah. You must have met Wallace Carruthers at least. Or
yes, I met him a number of times. I liked the man very much. In fact, I knew him a little bit socially when he lived out there with two or three other men, that little house. I forgot Colonel somebody's house out there. And we used to go out there, particularly in the wintertime, do a little skiing around. Mm. Yeah, Wallace Carruthers was an awful nice fellow. He told the poor devil had awful migraine headaches. And I think that's what happened to him. Just couldn't take it anymore.
He had a long-standing problem with depression.
There was some disagreement or disappointment in the way research was going. He wanted to keep it pure research, and there was a great demand from upstairs to you can get your product and get some, get back into production.
That's pertinent, because that brings up some thoughts about Stein and Bolton.
Yeah.
I've heard from other people who were at in the chemical department in the 30s when Bolton took over, that there was a definite change.
He was all for pushing research into dollar sales.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
Stein was at the...
And I think that bothered Carruthers a great deal.
Yeah, I see. Well, I think... do you think that may have affected Carruthers then?
I think it was one that... That plus his migraine headaches and maybe the pressure to get stuff out of research and get it into commercial production.
Robert Julius Newland, did you know him?
Well, I wouldn't say I know him. I've met him many times. He was an interesting character. He was a great botanist.
Yes, he
used to like to come down and spend weekends, and he was quite a pal of Calcutt's. Calcutt was director of the Jackson Lab, and the two of them would spend their weekends roaming around the pines of Jersey.
Oh, the pine barrens.
Yeah, up there. And he was a botanist.
I found Father Newland listed on one of the chemical department organization charts in about the year. I don't remember. Did you remember that he had been here?
He used to come quite frequently, but as a consultant.
As a consultant.
Yeah.
But he was actually listed on the staff, not as a consultant that particular
year. I don't know about that. I always thought he was...
He'd spent maybe a few months here.
I thought he... I don't ever remember his staying for any extensive periods. He may have, but I remember him as coming quite frequently and staying weekends.
I'd never been able to confirm that with anybody else. I thought maybe you knew.
He was a very pleasant fellow. I liked he and his old pipe.
Oh.
I always picture him with his pipe.
Is that right? Now, you said elsewhere, I think you told John Smith that you made some neoprene desk holders for the Pope and for Father Newland, Bill Calcutt, and yourself.
Yeah.
Is that right? Newland was going over to visit the Pope.
That's right. That's right.
Are any of these pen holders still in existence?
I think that I sent mine over to Hagley.
Uh-huh.
I think they have it.
Yeah.
It was around, about so thick, black, and with a pen holder molded into it when it was made. You stick a pen in it.
Interesting.
I believe that's over at Hagley.
Yeah. They ought to treasure that if they have it. Well, you probably knew some DuPont presidents and chief executives in some way.
Well, the one that I knew at all was Lamont DuPont.
And you indicated in your earlier interview that he was strongly supportive of the...
He supported research and supported the kind of work that we were doing, the application work. I remember his sitting on the corner of my desk as I was hitting and saying, quizzing me about neoprene, this is early days. He says, if we've even got a one shot in a thousand, I'm going to support it. If you think it looks like it had any chance at all, because we can take if this is a start and we can spend money to develop it. And that was very encouraging.
Walter Carpenter, did you...
Very personable man.
Uh-huh.
Very personable man. Made you feel entirely at ease when you went to see, when he'd call you up in his office. You just relax. First thing you do, hand you a cigarette or a cigar, and just relax. And I could talk to him just like I'm talking to you.
Mm-hmm. Now, he was apparently much involved at the start of the war in the question of how much expansion you're going to have in neoprene, and
very much.
He had some reservations about. In fact, he was against it, I think.
Well, I didn't have that part of it. I would be more attentive when he would ask me what I thought about the quality, what are the prospects of putting the into the field, and where would he be used, things and subjects of that sort. But beyond that, I had no nothing.
Questions of investment policies.
No investment policies and all that. That was
plant size didn't.
No, that would be Ed Robinson.
You were certainly involved, probably in. Weren't you involved in some way in market estimates, or did you just?
Oh yeah, well we all yes, sure, forecasting and estimates. Yeah, yes indeed.
Do you have any dealings with Crawford Greenwalt?
Very few, just casual. No. No.
And Pierre DuPont and Irene DuPont had.
Well, I never. I didn't know those. I didn't know those men at all. They were just names. Saw them, knew who they were, but I never had any close relationship.
Uh-huh.
That is with the old Pete and the old Pierre and Irene.
You mentioned Clifford Sanderson earlier.
Well, Cliff Sanderson was one of us three at Fisk.
Ah, I see. That's what's.
And he was the senior of the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
And when Fisk was taken over by U.S., Cliff left and went with Goodyear.
Uh-huh.
And the other fellow, Joe Partenheimer, he went with. Standard Oil in New Jersey, and headed up Atlas Group, Atlas Tires, Atlas Automobile Accessories, and he was with them until he retired. He's still living.
Yes, you had a clipping, I guess that's the reason I, you had a clipping, apparently from Artis's Worcester Polytech bulletin or journal about Sanderson.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I...
Yeah, well, Cliff was a very close friend of mine.
Mm-hmm. Your association continued then through the rubber division or just personally? Years
with Cliff?
Cliff.
Well, of course, he was a senior of us three kids at Fisk.
Yeah.
And I always kept in contact with him socially.
Yeah. Herbert Walker.
Herb Walker?
Herb Walker, yeah. Well,
Herb is one of the boys over at Jackson Lab. Did you know him?
Oh, yes. I know him. In fact, he was finishing his volume on the chemistry and technology of neoprene and when I arrived. And one of the first things they did to all of the new people coming in was to say, go in and talk to Herb Walker and find out from him what you ought to know. it was interesting.
Yes, I knew Herb.
He told me a lot of tales about the. He's a very capable man, I think. I was looking
Herb, at yes, he was.
Reports and patents and.
He's a pretty good fellow.
Yeah. You had mentioned Dr. Ira Williams, so I guess we'll.
Ira Williams was a real original man, original thinker. Original door. He was the most fertile mind. This is aside from the whole thing, but Ira came, he went over to Woodstown and bought himself a house. And he liked boxwood, so he had a row of boxwood on either side of his sidewalk going into his house. The dogs was coming down the street, would turn up on the boxwood down at the end, and it would burn them. And I used to go over to see Ira quite often. I noticed the boxwood looked pretty good. I said, what'd you do with this? He said, I know how to fix these dogs and save my boxwood. He said, I got myself a little dachshund and I got a muzzle. And I soldered the darning needle in the end of that muzzle. And he says, the dogs would come down the street to visit, he'd go out to and greet the other dogs, and they'd take off. So they had no more trouble.
I thought you were going to tell me he had a chemical.
No. He made most all of his own equipment. He was unique.
What happened to him?
He left and went with the J.M. Huber colors and carbon black people. He went down to Borger, Texas, headed up their research. I wouldn't want this in this part of it here about him.
Okay, let's...
But that's an incident that I wouldn't want in the tape.
Well, it's not. I put it on the card. Yeah. But the gist of it is that he did go down to Texas and he died a few years later. Ernest R. Bridgewater was your boss, I guess. And what was his background?
He went to Tech. I always called it Boston Tech, MIT, but he didn't graduate. I think he left during the war, and as I remember, went to work in the Bureau of Standards with Lewis, and they worked on gas. Then he went with Goodrich, and it was from Goodrich that I have a hunch that Kinsman hired him from Goodrich.
Vic Cosler was...
Vic was a character. That's old Vic there, standing up back there. Vic was a character. He was a very competent man. He had been in Goodrich for years. And then he went to Cooper Hewitt, I think it was, as a technical superintendent of their plant in mechanical rubber goods. And he was brought into our group to head up what we called indirect selling. That is to go out and show a prospective customer how, by using our product, he could substitute it for something else or make a new one that was far better than anything in the field, and therefore he'd have a lucrative business. And that was cost for it. He was very good at that, an exceptionally good man. And he stayed until he retired. Had he retired out before he just dropped dead? I think so. He died of heart.
Bert Lattimore is a...
He's a publicity man. And very, very good man. He's still doing some of that publicity work. He's retired, lives in Port St. Lucie, Florida.
You mentioned in one of your, I guess it was in your talk at Montreal, you mentioned Mel Lerner of Rubber Age.
Mel, he was a good friend of ours, put it that way. And he was always receptive to anything that was new, and he gave us a lot of publicity about neoprene.
Was he a technical man or
He was he was the editor of the Rubber Age. I think he had some technology background.
And you mentioned also Pete Pino of Rubber World.
Well, Pinto, same sort of a thing.
I worked with Howard Starkweather Jr., so I'm particularly interested in Howard Starkweather Sr.
Howard Starkweather Sr. was a very fine man. He was a Quaker, and true to a Quaker, he was a very plain sort of person, but as honest as the day is long, his word was, nothing was stronger than his word for anything. He was a very high principled person. He was very strict. He was in his morals, and he didn't drink, he didn't smoke, but still was liked by everybody.
He became a very competent man.
He's a graduate of Harvard, a PhD at Harvard.
Sam Lerner, I suppose you knew.
I knew Sam. Yeah, I knew Sam when he was in short pants. That's not literally true, but I know when he first came to work. Uh-huh. And worked in Jackson, worked in Tech Lab in the dye end of it.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
He lives out of the Quaker place.
Oh, Sam, he's...
Sam isn't a Quaker.
Huh?
Sam's not a Quaker.
No, but he lives out of the...
Oh, he does live now. He lives at... No, he lives over here. No. I call it Turkey Coop House, Farm, Turkey Ranch place, but...
I think I know where...
It's out near Hocassin.
Yeah, okay. Harold Ellie was research director when I came.
Harold Ellie is one of my very closest friends. Uh-huh. So anything, I might be biased. I liked Harold Ellie. He's a very fine man, very much of a gentleman, and very competent, I thought.
Yes, yes. He, musician, too, as I recall.
Oh, yes. He was a beautiful pianist and a very good organist. His recreation used to be go over to Will Raskob's place, where Raskob had a pipe organ in his music conservatory, and he used to go over there Saturdays to play that organ. That was his recreation.
Let's see, you mentioned E.G. Robinson has been mentioned earlier, but I don't...
he was our general manager.
He was
Swarthmore graduate and had been at the experimental station in the early days.
And Frederick B. Downing, I remember, he was...
Oh, Fred Downing. Fred had a lot to do with early days in neoprene.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
I'd associated him more with tetraethyl lead.
Well, he went from lead, tetraethyl lead, he came over and got into the... He was section leader or group leader under which the work on neoprene was done at Jackson Laboratory. Fritz Downing, we called him.
Yeah, Fritz.
Yeah.
Yeah. He preferred that. In fact, I was saying earlier, it was all first names over there at Jackson.
Always.
In fact, I was warned when I arrived, do not call Mr. Tinker Doctor.
No.
John Tinker.
John. John Tinker.
I don't know. I don't know how the people that without the PhDs were particularly conscious of it or not. There were quite a few people around who did very well without PhDs.
Yeah.
In the company.
Sure. And John was one of them.
Yeah. He's in one of the retirement pictures that you, gave me.
Would be, yeah.
Do you remember him? Of course, he was diachemistry mainly, wasn't he?
John?
Yeah.
Oh. He came from Newport, so he must have been.
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah.
Of course, Nick Carter.
Well, Nick, of course, he grew up in Jackson Lab.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick was pretty good. He was an acetylene man, really. I always thought of him as being one of the good acetylene chemists.
Was he responsible in some way for the monumental acetylene plant or something at the Chambers Works?
Well, I don't know if he was responsible for it, but he was very, very much tied up with it.
I can remember.
I think on the design end of it, Freddie Mitchell probably was had more to do with it than that.
At Carter's retirement party, they were ribbing him, this various things, and one of the things they showed us as an accomplishment was a building on fire. And the older people laughed, and I didn't understand what that was about. It had to do with the...
He was involved, of course. That was monovinyl acetylene. They got loose, that fire. And I always think of Herb Walker. He had monovinyl acetylene. He put it aside. Next morning, he came in. He had a pencil and stuck it in the test tube, and bang, it went. You know, burned his face, burned his eyelids off, burned his hair off.
can remember a story about somebody, and maybe you know to whom this, somebody who had a little ball, presumably had a little ball of, and I thought it was a divinyl acetylene polymer or something, sitting on his desk.
Well, they wouldn't have been fooling around with a ball of that, unless they had a ball of
anyway, this little ball of rubber-like material spontaneously paralyzed one day. Do you recall any stories like that?
It did what?
It paralyzed, you know, just spontaneously paralyzed or burned. Just took.
Well, pyrolyzed.
Pyrolyzed.
Oh, pyrolyzed, yes. It the gel would. Yes, I remember. Monovinyl acetylene, a divinyl acetylene, would rapidly, very rapidly, within a matter of hour, maybe minutes, would form a peroxide. And that peroxide was a gel. And as you went through that stage, if you disturbed it, you were in trouble. That was in the test tube, and Herb just had to touch it with a pencil. I remember another time, when it was fully polymerized, was the most as inert as silica. We thought we wouldn't be able to coat chemical drums because it's absolutely inert. And one of the experiments was they covered, they painted this on the rubber laboratory table as a table cover over soapstone. They come in the morning and somebody dropped a hammer or pliers or something on it.
I just had a few more things to finish up. Maybe look at some of the pictures that you gave me and you have shortly. We pretty well covered the people. H.H. Abernathy, that's the name that rings a bell, but I...
Herman Abernathy?
Uh-huh.
Well, Herman is one of our young men in the group. He's a very capable young man. He's a graduate of, Emory. I think either Emory or University of Georgia. I think it was Emory. And I think he had a master's. He's very competent. He's an aggressive young man and a pretty good chemist. He started out in Jackson Laboratory as a cub, a chemist, got into the polymer work and the latex, neoprene latex, was taken over into our group in the commercialization of latex, and worked with old Ben Dales, who was a kind of the godfather of all this chemical, all of the latex work in our division. And Herman is still living. Herman is retired. In fact, I'm going to have lunch with him tomorrow. A very capable young man. He did a very good job, I think, with the company. And after I retired, he got more into the commercial side of it. He had a lot to do with the Japanese contract. And spent quite a bit of time in Japan on that. He's a very smart young man.
He's got four very smart children.
Oh,
his
children are smart.
Yes.
Well, it seems to be a tendency among some of our colleagues and contemporaries. Well, now we're into retirement and politics, perhaps. This photo of you holding an FDR.
Oh.
I assume that's your Travis party. I assume that's some comment on your report.
Well, FDR wasn't held in my highest respect.
I see.
That's made of dimes.
Oh, really?
I used to have a thing, you know, just carried along, and I used to say, if I got a Roosevelt dime, I'd just throw it away. I wouldn't carry it in my pocket. And so they began putting dimes, and they made that FDR out of Roosevelt dimes.
Do you have any kinder feelings now about Roosevelt?
Oh, well, no, of course. Most of that was put on. Just, you know, you get into a thing, you just got to keep it up. And of course, Roosevelt was. Because I was very much annoyed at the Bosman was the way he treated Mr. Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
I never quite forgive him for that.
I can remember the New Yorker cartoons from the early Roosevelt days.
Yeah.
About the Peter Arnold cartoons, I think. I don't know if you remember some of these.
Yeah.
The Dowagers getting together to go down and piss Roosevelt, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
This is a picture of somebody with you in your office, and then somebody.
Pete Murawski.
Pete Murawski?
Pete was our salesman in New York.
Oh. Uh-huh.
He was the salesman that called on the electrical trade, mm-hmm. and particularly had a great deal to do. The establishment of neoprene as a coating for secondary wire distribution of electricity.
And here's one of Archie Meese.
That's Archie Meese, who was the manager of our West Coast sales.
Mm-hmm.
And next to him is Stan Ford, who was the production manager for the Organic Chemicals.
I remember Ford.
And there's I, and then John Tinker. And we're on the end there.
Yeah, we've already mentioned
yep.
John. These are two more.
All right. Bill.
No, but I can see it in my eyes.
Get under the.
Is Bill Askew? He was. He grew up. He started at Jackson Laboratory and got into this rubber latex work, and he did quite a world in there working again with old Ben Dales and Herman. He and two worked together, but Bill's a salesman, and he got into sales and did a very excellent job for us. And the other fellow is Vale Costler, who was in the indirect selling.
Yeah, we have mentioned him before.
Yep.
Well, this is another one, Dorothy.
See a picture of Cos and Bill.
Well, I guess the final. Let's say a little bit about your retirement. You mentioned that earlier, but you said you got involved in.
John Jessup and. A group of retirees. He formed a Delaware Citizens Crime Commission, and our objective was to visit the courts. This was authorized by the Supreme Court of Delaware. And from a layman's point of view, visit the courts and report back as to how we felt the courts were being operated. I think two accomplishments that I think we were responsible for the change in the magistrate system, and I think we were responsible for a change in the bail state system. Mm-hmm. We found so many people on bail had been put out in the workhouse and forgotten, been there perhaps a year or more before they were brought to trial. We've established, as a result of our work, a rotating fund for providing bail so that these people would be, depending upon what they were there for, misdemeanors, things of that sort, they would be put out on bail. See, if a man couldn't provide bail, he was put out there in the slammers, as
mm-hmm.
they say.
Yeah.
And some folks were left out there for months, forgotten. And I think those two things we accomplished a great deal. We there are other things that we are accomplished that I don't want to talk about, but very, very, did a lot of good work.
And you're active in Masons, of course.
Oh, yes, I was very inactive for many years, and after I retired, I thought I better take advantage of my friendship. Mason meant a great deal to me in the First World War. It really did. And then I was too many busy with many other things for years. I didn't go into a lodge at all. Then I became a Shriner and got interested in the Shrine work. And as I say, I'm interested in it. I never took any, never had an office in it, never took any part in any of the... I always enjoyed the nice things about Mason and the friendships that I developed through it. But I never was what you call a good Mason. I didn't go to lodge day after day or night after night or go to, never took any work in the ritual. But I've always had a nice, every Monday I go down to Hearn's. Here with a group of old has-been Shriners, about 20 of us, they have lunch together.
Uh-huh.
Fridays, I used to go down to the Masonic Temple. They have a very nice luncheon down there and have very good speakers. I used to go there, but today I can go down on the bus, but I can't walk from the bus terminal, that is from the... The bus ends at 9th and Shipley, and I can't walk from there over to 8th and Market.
Oh.
It's just too much for me. I don't go. After this stroke, I put my car away, and it's in storage. I'll probably get it out, I hope, in the spring, maybe in the summer I'll be able to ride again, but I don't feel capable of driving now because I don't have enough coordination between my mind and my feet or my mind and my hands. Uh-huh. I'm never sure. If I hit an emergency, I probably wouldn't be able to kick a brake.
Don't they provide a bus or shuttle service here at Fort Minor North?
Yes, they go down once a week. They go downtown once a week to Fairfax, once a week to Bramah Plaza, once a week up to Concord.
I guess if you feel like it, I'd like some of your comments about the state of the profession, if you like, rubber chemistry or polymer chemistry in general, or polymer technology, let's say. Very radical changes during your life.
Well, radical changes. As a matter of fact, I can't even understand some of the language. Far out of it.
I have the same problem.
The organic chemistry that I had, it was very, very primitive beside what we have today. I don't know that I could follow really first year organic chemistry. A lot of it, I'm sure, is way beyond what I ever had in college.
I'm afraid a lot of the introductory chemistry now starts with quantum theory.
I think it does.
I never had a great deal of use for that.
Well, I just had it as something I heard about, very little was done with it.
You're really out in the trade or in the business more than in the research.
Yes, I was out in that. The field of technology made two tremendous strides, and I hate to say that war brought these strides on, but I think of the First World War and the great strides in serology, for example. In medicine, it was a tremendous stride. Then the sulfa drugs came in, a tremendous stride. And then the Second World War came more to the electronics, the computer, the tremendous strides. In both cases, it was due to the the effort and the focusing of brains on projects that they affected more, yes, but they also have been translated into business, into everyday use. Who ever thought a computer would be on everybody's desk? As for example.
Well, certainly, World War II gave DuPont a big boost on the nylon and neoprene.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, nylon was just barely out when the silk supply.
You know, when I think of it in my own life, I've seen the automobile come and go. I can remember in school, I let the whole school out to go out to the road to see an automobile go by, first automobile go by. I've seen the trolley car, the old come and go. I've seen the automobile start off from the crudest sort of a thing. Matter of fact, I can remember as a boy when there was an old chap there in our town who was a sort of inventor, and he had an upright boiler on an old farm wagon, and he stoked it with charcoal soaked in fuel oil, or kerosene, and you have to stop at a watering trough to get water in it, but it would chug along in the parade or something of that sort. There's so many things that I've seen come and go. I've seen the telephone come. The telegraph was there when I was young, of course. I can remember very clearly when the new century came in. Although we lived about 3 miles away from the town, I can remember the church bells ringing at midnight, and the one factory there, they tied the whistle down and let it blow. I remember Halley's Comet, how beautiful it was, going from completely the whole horizon, and so many things I've in my own lifetime have come, many of them have gone, been replaced for the better, usually.
Jim, I noticed you have a Stan Ford picture there too.
Yeah. Stan Ford,
right.
Yeah, let me bring this other picture over and see if there's some new people.
Okay. Well, the fellow that's standing there is that's Vic Kossler.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's Vic Kossler. And he's a great guy. This fellow was Seward Byam, sales manager of neoprene in the early days. Cabby Barrow, sales manager of rubber chemicals, and a real salesman. Ernest Bridgewater here, Costner here, and I was here.
It looks like this would have been taken back in the early
50s. Oh, it must have been when they were, I think probably as we'll say at the 25th anniversary of that would be 25, 32,
57
maybe. 57,
uh-huh.
That was somewhere along in there, right. Or a little earlier. I don't know just when it was done, but it was done as a in publicizing neoprene. These were the five old fellows I said that made to put neoprene across, commercialized it.
That may be in one of the publications I picked up.
It may well be.
You were talking a little bit about the DuPont company earlier when we were having tea, and I think you might want to make some comments about the changes you've seen in the company itself over the years. While you were commenting earlier about how the company took care of its employees.
Before the days of pensions. And I just a couple of incidents that I know. We had an old fellow, his name was Johnny Craig, that was an old, had been an old powder monkey, and he was working with the construction gang on the over at the chain bricks and dye works, and they wanted a screwdriver, or a piece of pipe, or some tool they didn't have. They asked Johnny to go and get it. Well, in the middle of the bottom of the depression, one day I saw Johnny on the ferry going back home at night, and Johnny was kind of down at the mouth, and I said, "What's the matter, Johnny?" And he said, "In those days, the place was so small, you knew everybody on the plant, really, by their first name." And Johnny said, "You know, Mr. Hayden," he said, "I got laid off." And I said, "You did?" And he said, "Yes, I got laid off. And I feel pretty badly about it. I've worked for the company a good many years." Next morning, he's back on the ferry. He's all kind of smiles. And I said, "What happened to you? I thought you said you got laid off." "Well," he said, "I'll tell you. I went home and got talking. My wife and I was having supper, and I told her I got laid off, how badly I felt about it. And she said, 'Why don't you go and see Peary?'" And he said, "You know, I thought about it." And he said, "I got my son. He had an automobile. So he drove me over to Longwood. And he said, I went up at the front door, and I rapped on the door. And said, a man came out the door and said, I wanted to see, it was Mr. Peary at home. And he said, a voice came back, says, 'Come on, Johnny, what you doing? What do you want?' And he said, 'Mr. Peary brought me in.' He said, 'What's the matter, Johnny?' He said, 'Mr. Peary,' I said, 'I got laid off today.' And he said, 'Johnny, you go back to work tomorrow morning. Take your old job up, and if anybody says anything, you tell them to call me.'"
So
I said, "Well, how'd you know?" He's always said, "Me and Peary always played together as boys over in Hagley Yard when we was kids."
Right.
but I really cite that as the way they used to look after their people. They knew the people. They knew their people. They knew their families. They knew. And we were pretty much expected to know our people and their families. And if they were in need, do something about it. We had one man on the dye works whose principal job was, if you knew of something, you just tell him, and very quietly he would be taken care of. That's just an example. We had another one. I remember I had two old fellows working for me. I'd been given to me to give a job. They were old powder monkeys. One day, the young chemist came in to me and said, "No, Horace is getting holding up. He isn't holding his load. Isn't doing the work." He says, "We go out to the..." I had him running the storeroom for whatever you need to work with, and he falls asleep. So I said, "You come on in, we sit down, I want to talk to you." I said, "You know, there's no pension system." But he said, "Someday you may be old and you aren't old enough to hold your own job. You'd be damn thankful if you got a job out. You could just come in if you can punch the clock and do some work. Maybe you have to be, you have a, like old people do, fall asleep, what they call it, necrolepsy or something of that sort. Old Horace is going to have a job as long as he can come in and push the clock."
It's a bit different now.
Oh, sure it is.
You've seen that, have you? Yeah. Following the papers?
Yes, I know, it's quite different. But there was a certain amount of compassion. You felt you were responsible for the people that you worked for you. And that wasn't unique in my organization. It was unique throughout the company. I'm sure there was a lot of dead wood. Of course, the company was making money, and it was easier.
Well,
That may have been part of what was behind it.
But it was
perhaps for the depression thing. Pretty good for that.
But there's an untold number of young men that have been put through college and given an education that was never known by the public. Untold number by individuals. Even people on the, you've heard of old Doc Humphrey? Over at the Chambers work? You ever know him?
Name sounds familiar.
E.C. Humphrey, Basic Colors Superintendent. Mm-hmm. He was a character, and he's a pretty rough character in lots of ways. But many's the boy he's put through college on his own that I know about. And there was a lot of that that was done.
Well, the pension plan must have come in when?
I can't tell you when it came in,
Easter,
but...
I can't recall. It was well established when I came on board, of course.
I don't know when it came in, but it wasn't when I came in.
Well, I talked with John Smith, and he had some tapes. He did some tapes of his interviews with her at U, and he was preparing that history of neoprene in 1980.
You have his report?
In fact, I've got a copy. Would you like to have a copy?
I have a copy.
The publication you gave me.
I have it, he gave me one.
But he has never had your tapes transcribed from those earlier interviews. That contained a lot of the neoprene sort of thing. If he's willing, would you like to have us transcribe those tapes and maybe include them as part of this?
Go ahead. If you want, it didn't do any good for you.
Well, I mean, they're really your... And your property when we...
Well, I was signed out all over to Hagley.
Yeah, I understand that. What we will do is when we get the transcription and condition for you to look at, well, you have...
Well, I'd be glad to look at it. I don't think anybody in my family is a hoot. What I did.
Well, you've had an outstanding career and certainly an interesting story you've told.
Well, I had a lot of fun, put it that way.
I'll be back to see you with the final transcript and some release to sign and so on.
Yeah, okay.
I can't tell you how soon it'll be transcribed, but it depends on how good they are. So this ends this particular interview.